Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, July 16th, 2025, and our friend John Helmer is back with us. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Nima. Good to be back.
John, let's start with what's going on between the United States and Russia, Donald Trump. We had a report on Financial Times. They're talking about that Donald Trump, behind the scene or somehow secretly, was asking Zelensky about the capabilities of Ukrainians attacking deep into the Russian soil, maybe hitting Moscow. And we had a meeting between the NATO Secretary General and Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is willing to send weapons to Europe to finally get in there to Ukraine to fight Russia. What's going on? What are we witnessing with the case of Ukraine? Are we expecting a Russia's Arachnik moment coming to the scene?
Well, the Arachnik moment comes for Russia when the United States attacks Moscow or St. Petersburg with new missiles. And when Trump's behavior reflects itself into actions which indicate that there's no point any longer in trying negotiation. What Trump, the President Trump, has said since Monday, what he said during the press conference with NATO Secretary General Rutte indicated that he doesn't understand any of the Russian negotiating terms. He doesn't understand them. He hasn't heard them. He can't remember being briefed on them. All he can remember is what he said on the telephone with President Putin. He's repeated it over and over again, and that's a very indicative. It's indicative of the fact that Russia has made several negotiating efforts, plus a ceasefire on attacks on energy infrastructure in Ukraine. And it has stuck to that ceasefire until the last couple of days. Trump doesn't appear even to know. More than that, he directs his subordinates to repeat the line, there's been no Russian, quote, reciprocity. Well, in fact, there has been a great deal of it, but Trump isn't aware of it. He's the one who is not serious about negotiating. Although what he said during the Rutte press conference was that Putin isn't serious. And this endless repetition of slogans that he's disappointed with Putin, or that Putin says pleasant things on the phone and then he escalates. The reality on the ground is exactly the opposite. In addition, Russia has been repeatedly asking the Ukrainian side to confirm the third round of talks in Istanbul. The Russian side proposed June 22, which is coming up a week from today. No answer from the Ukraine. On the basis of what Trump said during the Rutte press conference on Monday, and on the basis of the telephone call leaked to the Financial Times, as you've vindicated, the telephone call between Trump and Zelensky, there's nothing left to negotiate. Now, that's a change of Trumpian policy, if you like. The Russian side, for the time being, is trying to say the negotiating position is open. We invite the Ukrainians to come back to Istanbul. The Russian side has not attacked Rutte for declaring that the Russian side sent an unserious negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky. In fact, it stressed his rank at sub-presidential level. So the Russian side on the spokesman level, that's Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, has been trying to play down each of the Trump behaviors, let's call them, each of the Trump threats since Monday. So, for example, Peskov said this morning regarding the threat to attack Moscow. Quotes, all this most often turns out to be fabricated, though sometimes serious leaks appear, including in media outlets we used to consider highly reputable. That's playing it down, isn't it? It's suggesting that what was said might have been faked. That's impossible. We all know that. So what remains to be understood then is what Trump does next. Well, he made two brief press appearances yesterday as in front of his airplane. And in one case, he was asked specifically, should Zelensky target Moscow, sir? Should Zelensky target Moscow or deeper into Russia? That was the question. Trump, no, he shouldn't target Moscow. Question, is that why you gave him more weapons, though? Are you willing to give long-range missiles to Ukraine as well? And are you happy about the 50-day ultimatum? Trump's reply, no, we're not looking to do that. Now, you could say, and the Russians' public position is, we're trying to accept that the president is not making the threats that have been published. But if he does, and this is unsaid, the view in Moscow is there must be an escalation on the Russian side. If there is that level of US involvement in an attack on Russian hinterland, deep, that will be revealed by the kind of missiles that that the United States is, quotes, selling to the NATO allies, Britain, Germany, Finland, the Netherlands, and so on. And these might be JASSMs, Taurus missile, the German one, ATACMS, just to take the American ones, JASSMs, ATACMS, and Tomahawks. The longest range of those missiles is the Tomahawk, which has got a range of anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 kilometers. That's in addition to the Patriots. Now, there is no information whatever about whether those offensive missiles will be supplied to the Ukrainians. If they are, and then if they're used, the story will be they went to the NATO allies, the European allies then gave them to the Ukrainians, and with 50 to 100 European men manning these weapon systems, will fire them at Moscow or St. Petersburg, or combine it with the type of operation which we saw on June the 1st, that is domestic drone attacks, which were then used against the nuclear bomber fleet, as we've discussed before. So you have, over the last 48 hours, a great deal being said, a great deal being threatened, a great deal not revealed. As Trump himself said, talk doesn't talk, actions do. So the Russian side waits to see what action, and the two tests of action would involve a reassertion of Russia's escalation control, escalation dominance. And ultimately, if there is a long-range US missile attack, no matter what Europeans help Ukrainians fire it at Moscow or St. Petersburg, there'll be an Oreshnik retaliation.
John, here is what Donald Trump said in terms of who's going to send the missiles for Patriot systems to Ukraine.
From what countries?
Coming in from Germany and then replaced by Germany, and in all cases, the United States gets paid back in full.
Have you started?
What's happening, as you know, is the European Union, if you look, mostly European Union, but let's put it in the form of NATO. It's very similar. But NATO is going to pay us back for everything. In some cases, we're going to be paid back by countries of the European Union.
It's so dangerous. You see, the president of the United States sees the situation in Ukraine as a business, as something that he can make some sort of benefit for, I don't know, for the military industrial complex in the United States or for himself. Do you feel that those people who were somehow optimistic about the Trump presidency and the way that he would manage the situation with Ukraine, they're just... Their hope has been destroyed by the administration.
Yes. I can't see any grounds for having any optimism whatsoever that Trump represents an alternative peacemaking, negotiating alternative to the Biden administration. There's nothing of that left. However, what there is, we have to look at it very carefully, is what rational constraints still exist on this certifiably mad president saying the things he says? And is there a way in which Russian side can, with respect to the Ukraine war, create significant deterrence to limit, restrict, deter, or force Trump to retreat away from an escalation, which, if it becomes direct between the United States and Russia, would regrettably go nuclear very quickly, even though the Russian side has a non-nuclear Oreshnik conventional munition weapon to use. So if it's the case, and some of the underlings in the administration seem to think that the US can capture escalation dominance on the Ukraine battlefield, now using the missile list that I just gave you, in addition to the Patriot missile defense systems that are being proposed, 17 of them, that's $17 billion worth. There are people in the administration or advising the administration who aren't as certifiably mad as Trump is, who think that they can be stronger than the Russian side, can go up the escalation and deter and defeat Russia. They can't. That's an illusion. But they seem to be willing to test Russia's military will now. And that's relatively new. But it should put an end to everyone who had any hope whatever that the new Trump administration would represent an alternative to escalation to war.
What they're talking about, John, in the United States about the sanctions, the tariffs, secondary tariffs to put them on Russia.
Yes.
Basically, they're talking about putting tariffs on China, India, and Brazil. Brazil yes. comes to the scene. And here is what the U.S. representative to NATO said on Fox News.
Reality is right now in Europe, they cannot manufacture the armaments required on the battlefield of Ukraine or on the battlefield if there was a potential war in Europe. And so the United States is the premier manufacturer of these weapon systems, and they're going to deliver them to Europe, and Europe's going to pay for them. And it's a really smart way to go about it. What's most important in this whole thing is it needs to be understood that the only way Russia conducts this war is because of selling oil. And the only way they sell oil is through their shadow fleet to places like India, Brazil, and most importantly, China, mm-hmm. who are continuing to enable this war. And it needs to end. And that's where how you end it is you go after the way it's funded. And that is funded through their oil being sold to those three countries primarily.
These are not some genius concepts that, because of China, India, and maybe Brazil, Russia is capable of continuing the conflict and winning the conflict, in my opinion. The same attitude, the same sort of idea has been going on with the Biden administration. They were talking about it. They did everything to convince India and China. They couldn't do it. Why in the world this administration is feeling that they're going to do it? They're going to be in a better position to deal with that.
Well, you're asking me to explain why American officials say those sorts of things. I think one should say, first of all, parenthetically, that one of the reasons these Trump administration officials are talking about delivering weapons to the Europeans to buy is it bypasses the requirement for congressional approval of arms supply on aid or grant terms to the Ukraine. This is essentially a system for evading congressional supervision. Not that that's particularly favorable to Russia, but it is an evasion of the cost that would be have to be paid by U.S. taxpayers and therefore endorsed by the Congress. This evades that fundamental political and fundamental constitutional and legal requirement. Why they then think that that you not only arm Europe to arm the Ukraine to continue the war and escalate the war, why you think you can defeat Russia by a system of new sanctions. You've just said every form of sanction against Russia directly, against China, against India, every form of sanctions been defeated. It's failed to support the losing war on the Ukrainian battlefield that's been waged. But there's no end to this kind of administration optimism, and it simply reinforces the point with which you began. These people think they can defeat Russia. Now, as Colonel Wilkerson said on your program a few hours ago, this is World War III. We're in World War III. This is a stage in which the U.S. empire is attempting to preserve itself, its control of the European part of its empire, the Asian part of its empire, its allies, and require them to pay more and more tribute to the center for the source of military supplies against the Russian enemy, and then the Chinese enemy, and the Iranian enemy, in whatever sequence of wars the Trump administration decides to be their priorities. So we're in a stage of war in which you've just exhibited one of the American officials saying he believes the U.S. can win this war to save the U.S. empire. They have no concept of mutual reciprocal security, not in Europe, as Russia proposed in December 2021, not in the Persian Gulf, as Russia's proposed with Iran and the Arab states in the Gulf for mutual reciprocal security in the Middle East, and not in Asia either. So these are World War III fighters. That's what you just showed. And just by the way, I do need to mention, said it last week, the attack on the Russian oil fleet is already underway, and it's military. Before secondary sanctions come on in allegedly 50 days, what's already happening are the secret services of the UK, the United States, and others are striking at Russian tankers, principally oil tankers, crude oil tankers, but also petroleum and petrochemical tankers in port at sea in the Mediterranean. They're actually using military means to attack what they've proposed now to be the secondary sanctions to deter that the movement of those vessels. So we're already at war. We've seen attempts by the Baltic Sea states to threaten or curtail the movement of these vessels. And that's required a military response that Russia is now escorting with corvettes and destroyers, tanker movements through the Baltic Sea to prevent and deter threats from Denmark, Poland, Germany, Sweden, and so on. So we're already engaged in World War III against the tanker movement, and secondary sanctions are relatively soft. Just bear in mind also what the secondary, we have a lunatic in charge, a certifiable maniac in the White House, but there's also the certifiable maniac in the US Senate, and that's Lindsey Graham. And remember what he said. After the 50 days are up on the 51st day, the author of these secondary sanctions said, if Putin doesn't understand, he needs to, what will happen on the 51st day, he needs to call the Ayatollah. Now, that's a combination threat of secondary sanctions against India and China. Now, the Chinese have, and the Indians have no inclination to obey that level of threat. And he's saying, we will bomb you, the Russian fleet, as if we bomb, just like we bombed the Iranian nuclear processing plants at Fordow and Natanz and Isfahan. So it's a combination of tactics in World War III at this stage.
Doesn't that mean that they're going to do some sort of assassinations by using Ukrainians?
Well, it's a very unpleasant topic. I would expect that all sorts of special operations, black operations, assassination operations, to be attempted inside Russia. And the appropriate Russian services are preparing for that. It was attempted in vain, but with serious personnel cost in Iran. And it will be attempted in Russia in such a way as to make it look as if it's domestic violence, terrorism. And we've already seen a couple of examples of that. The blowing up of bridges and the derailment of trains killing civilians. Termed terrorism, it's another element of World War III, in which the United States is waging war against Russia using cutouts, so-called terrorists, Ukrainians, and others. Yes, I'm afraid we're looking at that. But the issue really becomes, from Russian point of view, from the General Staff's point of view, what's the response that Russia should mount? You see, the argument for diplomacy, the argument for treating the President of the United States with respect, ignoring the mental and medical incapacities, in ignoring the expletives, the profanities, the insults, why ignore these things? The answer is to maintain the option for a negotiated, peaceful solution. If you're in world war, that may be no more than buying time to prepare the armies for the next round of clashes, whether it's on the Ukraine battlefield or on the southern front to defend Iran and Russia's interest in the Iranian-Russian border or the Caucasus or the northern front, including Finland and then the Arctic, or the Eastern Front, including China. Russia needs time and breathing space to construct the army and military forces necessary to continue, knowing that we're in World War III already, and to limit the dangers of escalation to nuclear weapons. So a certain amount of latitude, courtesy, civil communication, all of those things are required to provide time, buy time, to change public opinion at the cost and the risk to the Europeans for this kind of war. And that's the argument in Russia for trying to play down what Trump and his men are saying they will do and what they plan to do and what they will do. Play it down doesn't mean ignore it. Play it down means allow the possibility that there's another way out of, people call it the off-ramp, another way out of immediate escalation. And this week, Trump has behaved in such a way on Monday as to suggest that there's no off-ramp now. There's nothing left to negotiate because he can't understand the negotiating terms anyway. Let's just go back a minute. Last week, Foreign Minister Lavrov, and I believe we talked about it last Wednesday with you, Nima, last week, Foreign Minister Lavrov delivered to Secretary of State Rubio what Rubio called new idea, new concept. No disclosure on the Russian or the US side of what this meant. I believe it to mean, my sources in Moscow believe this new idea, new concept to mean a subset of the negotiating terms, the 33 terms that Russia tabled in Istanbul on last month, in Istanbul of the last round. A subset essentially prioritized. We can reach a ceasefire agreement if you halt arms supplies and intelligence sharing that generate attacks on the Russian hinterland and on the front. We can also accept a ceasefire if there are elections that remove Zelensky's regime and replaces it with a popularly elected one. Let's just say there are those two instead of 33, a subset, a new concept, a new idea. Let's go for the small, give Trump his ceasefire, give him his summit meeting with President Putin, give him the grandstand to say, I deserve the Peace Prize because I just pulled off a ceasefire with Russia, as he's been inventing with all these other countries, including some brand new ones, Egypt and Ethiopia this week. Incredible set of inventions. But let's remember that last week the Russians tried again. And Rubio said, I'll take it back to Washington. I'm not confident that the president will agree, but we will see. That's what the position was last Wednesday, Thursday. And what do we hear on Sunday? Trump says, announces a tweet, there's going to be a big statement. I'm going to make a big statement on this issue on Monday. And he did. But the very important thing to listen to there is what's missing from his brain. It's as if Lavrov never submitted anything. So there was no new idea, new concept that Rubio took to the president and they had a discussion about. Trump can't remember it. As far as he's concerned, all he can remember, as I said, was telephone calls with Putin. So if the president of the United States can't comprehend negotiating terms. He's essentially saying, capitulate, Putin, do what I say, or I'll bomb the daylights out of you. Or he used an expletive during the campaign. I will bomb the shit out of Moscow. That's what he said in a fundraiser during the campaign. Okay? Then if that's the mentality of the man, and I wrote a piece earlier this week in Dances with Bears to indicate this is a serious mental deficiency. Serious mental deficiency. And let's remember also, this man has inherited Alzheimer's disease in his family. His father died of it at the age of 86. His older sister died of it at age 86. His cousin died of it at age 84. Trump is now 79. To die of Alzheimer's disease, and it's been in my family, so I know what happens. You start to show significant dementia 4, 5, 6 years before death, sometimes 8. Trump is 79. His family died of Alzheimer's at 86. That's 7 years away for him. So the mental capacity of this man has to be understood when interpreting what he says. Okay, Russia has the medical competence to understand what's going on. So what we face is, if the president of the United States is mentally incapacitated to the degree he can't accept that our side, the Russian side, offer any negotiating terms, what are we left with but military escalation? And that's what's happening all along the front and in the rear. But Trump then turns around and says, I asked my wife about that, and she said, look at what the Russians did last night. Okay, we go round and round with him. But what about with the Germans, who are about to escalate? What about with the British? Not the French, not the Italians, not the Spanish. It's principally the Germans and the British now who are pushing Trump in this direction. The Finns and the Swedes and the Danes and the Norwegians will contribute, but they aren't drivers. The Germans are. So we come to, if the President of the United States can't comprehend negotiating terms, do any of the other allies comprehend? Well, we just heard the Dutchman, who's the Secretary General of NATO, he appears not to understand any terms the Russians have offered. He said Russia's not serious. Okay. No negotiation? Is that their position? That appears to be their position. If that's their position, whether they're mentally competent or not, if that's their position, Russia has to continue to appear, offer, try to talk, and fight more effectively, more forcefully, and assert escalation dominance, resume the electric war campaign, and try to bring the war to an end by the defeat, the capitulation of the Ukrainian side. What else is there to do?
Who's paying the weapons that Europeans, it seems that they're buying? I don't see France is having it. They're dealing with a lot of problems in France, in Germany the same way. The British government is dealing with somehow some financial problems, but they can pay for some of them. But who's paying for that? Do we have any sort of information on who's paying the most buying these weapons?
Well, at this point, on the basis of the numbers that we've seen, the Germans have to be leading with a 50 billion euro rearmament plan. The numbers are difficult for me as a once upon a time US government budget officer, because I can't see what kinds of numbers there are behind the publicity. Are they loans to directly to military producers in the country, the German arms manufacturers? Are they purchases, let's say, in cash delivered to the United States arms manufacturers? Are they loan guarantees? I don't know how it's being done. Also, I don't know that any that the House of Commons German Parliament or any parliament in Europe has authorized and approved the appropriations of the sums of money, bearing in mind one Patriot missile system with its missile load is approximately $1 billion. So all of this expense has to be approved by taxing the populations in countries which have very weak public-supported governments. Merz has the chancellorship with approximately 56% vote for him, himself and his party. Starmer had a walkover, a landslide election, but he's now facing significant disapproval. Macron, who's not paying, just as you said, not listed in the Trump list of payers, he has the lowest approval rate in Europe. In Finland, they've moved against President Stubb and the accession to NATO. The Finns are not at all happy about footing the bill. So the notion that the European electorates will support this war remains to be seen. One can't be very optimistic because there's very high levels of repression in each of those countries, especially Germany. The German regime is a very weak one, politically speaking, but very strong one in repression. Germans are afraid to express their own opinions about the war. They're afraid to say no war. And it's very difficult to count on the German electorate to stop this escalation to war between Germany and Russia. So we can't be confident that if the bill has to be paid by them, German voters will oppose it. So you're right to raise the question, who's going to pay? The German taxpayer will pay in the front, but won't be happy. And to deal with that, the Germans' police and security forces will repress those who express their unhappiness in political protest.
I assume that this case of Germany is much more critical for Russians because they're talking about long-range missiles, 2,000 kilometers that they can hit Russia, deep into Russian territory. Yes. How much of concern is because Germany is, look at the history, look at what's going on in the mindset of Russian people, what has happened. It's something big. Many people may not believe that Germany today can bring some sort of threat to Russia. But after all, we know the history. We know what's going on. We know the capabilities of missiles. This is the reality. And if not against Russia, who's going to be the enemy to be hit? These are questions in the mind of people.
Yes. It's very clear from the statements that German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius has made in the last few days. And remember, he's the leftover from the Schulz government. He was a SPD, Social Democratic Party minister in the Schulz government, which was defeated in the last election. But Merz has reappointed him defense minister. He leaves no bones, has no qualms, that's better to put it, in saying, also in his introduction to Washington, also in the Financial Times over the weekend, that Germany's ready to kill Russian soldiers if they attack Germany. Now, on the one hand, you could say it's obvious. Most people will kill any invader coming into your country. Second, it's not obvious. It's impossible. It's unlikely. It's improbable that Russia will attempt to attack Germany in the way he said. But the nature of the way he said it is to raise public support for defending Germany against the advancing Russian horde. It's race war of the Hitler period. I have to add that when he got to Washington, he has said in the German press, it's not in the Pentagon readout after his meetings with Secretary of Defense Hegseth, he said Germany will not provide Taurus missile, will not be providing the Taurus long-range cruise missile for attacks from the Ukraine in deep into Russia. Since that's what he said, and he could be lying, or he could be countermanded by Merz under US pressure, what one has to now believe is that the long-range missile capability that Zelensky has asked Trump for will be US weapons, not the Taurus. And I just ran through the list of them: Attackams, JASMs, and Tomahawks. And the longest range of those is a Tomahawk, if I understand it correctly. So it's Germany in the lead now, playing the Zelensky role. The U.S. is using Germany.
The longest, John, is Typhoon. It's 2,000 kilometers. Tomahawk right. is 1,500.
I stand corrected. Thank you. Yes.
Go ahead. You were.
No. I mean, if there's no Taurus, if Pistorius is to be believed, Taurus will not be allowed to the Ukrainians for attacks on Russia, then if there are to be attacks on Russia, they will be U.S. long-range missiles.
Yeah. John, the other issue is with the case of Azerbaijan, and they use Azerbaijan against Iran and against somehow they're trying to manipulate the situation against Russia. From what you've seen and you know about the case of Azerbaijan, can you provide us with the information that you have? Why is Azerbaijan? What is the importance of Azerbaijan in this somehow in this game against Russia and Iran? And how capable is Azerbaijan to go against them?
Well, let me quickly give you a brief bio of why I have good relations over a long period of time with officials in Baku. I had similarly good relations over time with Armenia and the Armenians. And of course, I'm based in Moscow. But for many years, I have, and this is fundamental to understand the Azeri-Russian crisis at the moment, because it's being misreported in the US press, in the Israeli press, in the Turkish press, in the Azeri press, and to some extent not reported properly at all in the Russian press. First of all, you have to understand the family around Ilham Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan. You have to know family relations, regional and family relations. And I've had family relations in Azerbaijan and in the Azeri part of Iran. Second, you have to understand business, the way in which money flows between Azerbaijan and Russia and Turkey and Iran. And you have to then understand how money and family connect the politics of Baku to Moscow, to Istanbul and Ankara and Tehran and so forth. When you mix family, money, and politics and military, you've got a very complicated combination of interests. And you have Turkey attempting to expand the Turkic influence across the Caucasus northwards and eastwards, pinching Iran. You have Iran protecting itself from an Azerbaijan, which has become a platform for Israeli attacks on Iran. You have the British in particularly have had long attempts in Azerbaijan and in Baku since before the Russian Civil War, but during World War One, the British attempts to make Azerbaijan a platform for British influence, control of oil, control of gas, and threatening from the southern front the Russian borders. You have the US having its own interest in trying to weaken Russia along the southern front. You have all of these players actively stimulating conflict and exploiting conflict. Now, when you've got family, money, and great powers all intervening, you have the capacity to blow out of proportion relatively small crises or events. And these go back to 1990 when I was involved with Prime Minister Hassan Hasanov, when I was involved directly in negotiations for Azeri concessions for the Shah Deniz oil and gas field, the largest in the country. I've had a lot of experience in that business line of business and understand the way in which the British come in, the Americans come in, the Turks come in, and so on and so on and so on. What we've now had in the last 6 months are two or three incidents which have been exaggerated and become a tit-for-tat crisis between Moscow and Baku. The first was the crash of Azerbaijan Airlines aircraft in Kazakhstan after it was hit on a flight between Baku and Grozny, Chechnya. It was hit by probably by Russian anti-aircraft defense particles. I'm not sure whether they were what kind of munition they were, but they left holes in the aircraft, and they've been visible. Why the aircraft coming from Baku went into a zone that was heavily jammed to prevent an oncoming Ukrainian drone attack on Grozny, why the plane wasn't kept away, why the pilots continued to fly into Grozny, I don't know, and that's not discussed. There were a lot of questions about why the pilots kept going towards Grozny when it had become a war zone, why they weren't diverted before they entered not only the jamming period, but the anti-aircraft an anti-drone defense area where they were hit. Then there's a question of whether the pilots could have diverted closer to Makhachkala, which is where Russian air control told them to go, but they refused. They went eastwards across the Caspian and they crashed near Akhtar on the Kazakh territory. And more 38 people, I believe, were killed, including the two pilots. So the pilots can't testify. Now, that's a major crisis. And what then happened was public demands for Ilham Aliyev, the president, whom I recall meeting when he made the coffee and served the coffee in an afternoon of conversation I had with his father, Gaidar Aliyev, in Moscow. Ilham is not a particularly strong individual. He is very responsive to a variety of pressures. And he's been increasingly politically more confident since he since Azerbaijan won back Nagorno-Karabakh and defeated the Armenian forces and recovered Nagorno-Karabakh, which had been lost to the Armenians 20 years ago. Okay, so a relatively underconfident president, newly confident, faces demands for a tough approach to Moscow. The day before the crash, President Putin had sent very cordial birthday greetings to Ilham Aliyev. The day of the crash, Putin said nothing. 2 days later, he conveyed in a telephone call his apology, and the wording of the Kremlin communique was for the incident that occurred in Russian airspace. He did not admit that the plane had been hit by Russian fire of munitions of one kind or another. Why he didn't? Deeply offended the Azeri side, deeply offended and didn't satisfy. And it has triggered very serious Azeri sentiment that Russia treats Azeris with less respect than it should. That process led to some tit-for-tat retaliation on the Azeri side to reduce cultural and political interactions between the two countries. Then what has happened in the month of June was a new round of incidents. I believe it was June 28, there was a very serious arrest and roundup of more than 50 Azerbaijanis, Azeris, in Yekaterinburg. And in the process of the arrest of these alleged criminal gangsters, led by the Safarov family, two of the Safarov family were killed, died, allegedly one of a heart attack. But the evidence when the bodies came back to Baku appeared to indicate they had been assaulted before their death, tortured, if you like, or that the violence they suffered during the arrest process caused their death. In any event, what the Russian side considered to be an anti-criminal gang matter has turned into a national insult for on the Azeri side. The Azeris then retaliated by making a highly media visible arrest of Russian journalists at Sputnik News in Baku. And these were making the perpetrators walk in chains and wearing handcuffs and generally insulting them for the benefit of public opinion. That was an Aliyev PR stunt responding to the Russian one. It was a way of saying Azerbaijan is an independent sovereign country. We don't appreciate the way in which the Russians treat us and mistreat us. By the way, there on February 2022, the two sides, Russia and Azerbaijan, signed a declaration promising each other to treat each other as independent sovereign with great respect. Whenever crises come up, they will have immediate consultations and what have you. So there's been since 1990 the breakup of the Soviet Union and the independence of Azerbaijan, which I witnessed firsthand with Prime Minister Hasanov at the time, and then with the return to Baku of Gaidar Aliyev from Moscow. There's a very strong feeling in Azerbaijan that Russia is heavy-handed and arrogant towards the Azeris. On the other hand, on the Russian side, there is a very strong feeling that the Azeri diaspora is visibly criminal. And the reason for that is it's visible in the vegetable markets, in the fruit markets, in the consumer, the green grocery markets that all Russians are familiar with. Everybody buys fruit, vegetables, and so forth. And the feeling is that Azeri gangsters and Azeri gangs dominate some of this trade and some of the markets. So the Russian side thinks, and Russian public opinion thinks, that there's a case to be made that should be greater enforcement. And ever since the Crocus City Hall affair, in which Tajiks were used by the Ukrainians to attack and kill more than 100 innocent Russian civilians in Moscow, there is a lot of hostility to the immigrant diasporas. And it takes a, publicly, it can have racist form. The governments, on the other hand, are trying to dampen this down. And the that's between Aliyev on the one hand and Putin on the other, between the Azeri government in Baku and the Russian government in Moscow. But there is attempts by the British, the Americans, the Turks, to stimulate the crisis between the two and to damage Russia's long-term influence in the Southern Caucasus. And so I've read an Israeli think tank version of these incidents, a US think tank version, a British think tank version, and they all emphasize the anti-Russian line. The Russian side, the Russian think tanks have kind of carefully avoided an analysis of the kind I've just spelled out. There are one or two, but generally the big Russian think tanks and platforms that are close to government thinking, like Vzhlyad, the daily internet publication in Moscow, have avoided analyzing this complex of issues. Why? Because they're complicated. Two, because they involve racist sentiment, emotion, and there's a strong feeling that it's best to let people cool off and avoid racist racial antagonisms, because they can break out in the street at fruit markets, for example. One wants to avoid that. President Putin has repeatedly tried to mitigate intercommunal violence in Russia, notwithstanding the concern that that the diasporas represent job insecurity, military and insecurity, the threat of terrorism, and what have you. So I don't know if I've explain to you how complicated it is and why I don't any longer know from friends in Baku how the Aliyev government sees the future past these incidents. I'm convinced, however, that both governments want to play them down now. Whether they will succeed or not, I don't know.
Yeah, hugely complex, as you mentioned.
Hugely so. And obviously, it's you can add the Iranian perspective. To the extent that the Israeli and American attack on Iran has just tried to break up, balkanize, partition Iran, and give the Azeri, the northeastern part of Iran that is ethnically Azeri, a chance to break away from Tehran, there's a very serious Iranian security concern about other powers meddling in Azerbaijan to make Azerbaijan a platform to threaten Iran. Am I right that there is a natural concern in Tehran that Ilham Aliyev is too weak and too dependent on outside forces, too susceptible, as are his business constituents, to business, to cash, to bribery, and so forth, in such a way as he would allow or tolerate or close his eyes to the use of his territory to threaten the partition and attack on Iran. Is that correct?
Yeah. The main concern, by the way, on the part of Iranians is not these sort of movements, but the presence of Israel in Azerbaijan. There's so much concern about that. Why do they need to be there? What is the role of Israelis in Azerbaijan? There is no, you know, a lot of things going on in the mind of the Iranian government, and they try to deal with it with Azerbaijan. They're trying to communicate, they're trying to somehow express their concerns in terms of the Israeli presence in Azerbaijan. And as you mentioned, the situation in Azerbaijan is so much complicated, even in the mind of Iranians. You mentioned the case of Russia, but in the mind of Iranians is the same, as I know.
Do I understand correctly that there are pardon me, leading figures in the clerical leadership of Iran who are ethnically Azeri?
Yeah.
As is, I believe, President Pezeshkian is himself. So
Kurd and Azeri is a combination of both.
Yes. Yeah. And that means extended family, that means regional loyalties. And in that part of the world, these regional loyalties can be mobilized against or for a political regime in the capital. That's true in Iran. It's true in Azerbaijan. And if you're MI6 or you're the CIA or you're the Mossad, you're always trying to mobilize that level of family money and let's call it regional ethnicity for the benefit of weakening or substituting or regime changing that would affect your great power games. And Ilham Aliyev, well, as I said, when I spent the afternoon with Father, Ilham was the butler. He made the coffee. He delivered it on trays. He didn't participate in any of the serious conversation. His father didn't treat him as part of our conversation, which covered Russian strategy and all of the things that Gaider Aliyev knew very well. But I'm long out of there, and I'm not in any position to assess the political strengths and vulnerabilities of the president of Azerbaijan. But right now we face something that needs to be understood without the inflammation of racial tension and without the inflammation of war. And Iran's just been attacked. We know that Israeli aircraft dropped fuel tanks as they used Azeri territory to attack northern Iran during the 12-day war. That's war, and that's very serious indeed. So both Iran and Russia share a problem. And neither Russia nor Iran wants to make an enemy at this point of Turkey. This is a fundamental strategic priority for both sides in this situation. Without getting into the complexities of how Moscow and Tehran do not trust the Turkish policy, we can at least say that it's more than courtesy. There is a strategic necessity here not to allow Azerbaijan to become a cockpit of conflict against Turkey. And that's a Russian priority. It's an Iranian priority. So I hope it helps our audience understand not to believe the exaggerations they read from Israel, the United States, or the British, not to believe racist slurs about anyone in this very complicated political contest with very big oil and money stakes.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, John, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima.